Chapter 50. Thorns. Rand spent the rest of that day in his apartments in the Sun Palace, a good part lying on his bed, a huge thing with four square blackwood posts thicker than his leg, polished till they shone between the inlaid ivory wedges. As if to contrast with all the gilding in the anteroom and sitting room, the bedchamber furnishings were all blackwood and ivory, if no less angular. Sulin rushed in and out, fluffing his feather pillows and adjusting the linen sheet over him, grumbling that blankets on the floor were healthier, bringing him mint tea he did not ask for and punch he did not want until he ordered her to stop. "As my Lord Dragon commands," she growled through a sweet smile. She made her second perfect curtsy, but she still stalked out as though she might not bother to open the door. Min also stayed with him, sitting on the mattress and holding his hand and frowning until he suspected she thought he was dying. Finally he chased her out, too, long enough to put on a dark gray silk robe that he had always left in the wardrobe before. He found something else in there as well, way in the back. A narrow, plain wooden case holding a flute, a gift from Tom Marilyn in what seemed another lifetime. Sitting by one of the tall, narrow windows, he tried playing. After so long, he produced more squeaks and silences than anything else at first. It was the odd sounds that drew Min back. "Play for me," she said, laughing in delight, or perhaps astonishment, and of course settled herself on his knee while he tried with small success to produce something near a recognizable tune. Which was how the wise ones walked in on him, Amice and Bear and Soralea, and a dozen or so more. Min scrambled up quickly enough, blushing at that, tugging her coat straight, to such an extent you would have thought they had been wrestling. Bear and Soralea were at his side before he could say a word. "Look left," Soralea commanded, thumbing back his eyelid and thrusting her leathery face into his. "Look right." "Your pulse is too quick," Bear muttered, holding bony fingers against the side of his throat. It seemed that Nandera had sent a maiden running as soon as his knees gave way. It seemed that Soralea had winnowed the small army of wise ones who had intended to descend on the palace into this smaller horde. And it seemed that Soralea or no Soralea, everyone wanted her turn at the Karakarn. When she and Bear were done, her place was taken by Amice and Bear's by Kalinda, a lean woman with penetrating gray eyes, who looked short of her middle years, yet had almost as strong a presence as Soralea. But then so did Amice, of course, and any number of them. He was poked, prodded, stared at, and called stubborn when he refused to jump up and down. They really seemed to think he would. Min was not ignored while the wise ones were taking their turns with him. The others surrounded her, asking 100 questions, all about her viewings, which widened her eyes to say the least, and had her staring at them and Rand, as if wondering whether her mind was being read. Amice and Bear explained, Melaine had not been able to keep the news of her daughters to herself, and instead of growing any wider, which they probably could not at that point, Min's eyes looked ready to fall out of her face. Even Soralea seemed to accept Melaine's view that Min's ability put her on an equal footing of sorts with them, but wise ones being wise ones. Very much in the manner of Aes Sedai being Aes Sedai, she had to repeat everything nearly as many times as there were wise ones, because those fussing over him at any given time wanted to be sure they had not missed anything. Once Soralea and the rest reluctantly concluded that all he needed was rest, and departed ordering him to see that he got it, Min made herself comfortable on his lap again. "They talk in dreams," she said, shaking her head. "It doesn't seem possible. Like something out of a story." A frown creased her forehead. "How old do you think Soralea is? And that Kalinda? I saw..." "No. No, it doesn't have anything to do with you. Maybe the heat is affecting me. When I know, I always know. It must be the heat." A mischievous light appeared in her eyes, and she slowly leaned closer, pursing her lips as if for a kiss. "If you put them like this," she murmured, when they were almost touching his, "it might help. There were bits in that last piece that almost sounded like Rooster in the Gum Tree." It took him a moment to understand, with her eyes filling his vision, and when he did, his face must have been a sight because she collapsed on his chest, laughing. A note arrived from Koiren a short time later, inquiring after his health, wishing he was not ill and asking whether she might come to see him with two of her sisters. She offered healing, should he desire. Luce Theron stirred as if rousing from sleep while Rand read, but his vague, discontented mumbling was hardly a patch on his rage in Camelin, and he seemed to go back to sleep when Rand put the short letter down. It was a sharp contrast to how Mirana had behaved, and a reminder that nothing happened in the Sun Palace at midday that Koiren did not know in full before sunset, if not sooner. He sent back polite thanks for her wishes, and a polite refusal. Out of bed or not, he still felt tired, and he wanted his wits about him when he faced any Aes Sedai. That was part of it. In that same return note, Rand also asked Gawain to visit. He had only met Elaine's brother once, but he liked the man. Gawain never came, though, and he never replied. Sadly, Rand concluded that Gawain believed the stories about his mother. That was hardly the sort of thing you could just ask a man to stop believing. It put him in such a gray humor whenever he thought of it that even Min seemed to despair of cheering him. Neither Perrin nor Loyal would stay around him when he was like that. 3 days later, another request came from Koiren, just as courteous, and a third 3 days after that. But he made excuses for those as well. In part, that was because of Alana. The feel of her was still distant and vague, but she was coming nearer by the hour. No surprise in that. He had been sure Mirana would choose Alana for one of the six. He had no intention of letting Alana within a mile of him, or not within sight anyway. But he had said he would put them on an equal footing with Koiren, and he meant it. So Koiren would have to abide in patience for a little while. Besides, he was busy, one way and another. A quick visit to the school, in Barthonas's one-time palace, turned out not so quick. Idrian Tarson was once again waiting at the door to show him all sorts of inventions and discoveries, often incomprehensible, and also the shops where various new plows and harrows and reapers were now being made for sale. But the difficulty was Herod Fell. Or maybe Min. Fell's thoughts wandered as usual, his tongue wandered after them, and he plainly forgot Min was there. He forgot her a good many times. But no sooner would Rand have the man aimed at a point than Fell suddenly noticed her for the first time again, and gave a great start. He was constantly apologizing to her for the half-smoked pipe he still never seemed to remember to light, constantly brushing ash from his stout belly, constantly smoothing his thin gray hair. Min seemed to enjoy it, though why she enjoyed a man forgetting her presence, Rand could not begin to say. She even kissed Fell on the top of his head when she and Rand rose to go, which left the man looking pole-axed. It did not help a great deal with learning what Fell had puzzled out about the seals on the Dark One's prison or the last battle. The next day brought a note crammed onto a torn-off corner of parchment. Belief and order give strength. Have to clear rubble before you can build. Will explain when see you next. Do not bring girl. Too pretty. Fell. It was a hasty scrawl with the signature jammed into the point of the fragment, and to Rand it made no sense. When he tried to reach Fell again, though, it seemed that the man had told Idrian that he felt young again and was going fishing, in the middle of a drought. Rand wondered whether the old man's wits had finally cracked. Min certainly found the note amusing. She asked if she could have it, and several times he caught her grinning over it. Cracked wits or whole, Rand decided that he would leave Min behind the next time, but in truth it was difficult to keep her at his side when he wanted her. She seemed to spend more time with the wise ones than with him. He could not understand why that should irritate him so, but he noticed a tendency to snap at people when Min was out among the tents. It was a good thing she was not with him too often. People would notice. People would talk and wonder. In Kyrian, where even the servants played their own version of the game of houses, it could be dangerous for her to have people wondering whether she was important. A good thing. He tried not to snap. What he wanted men for, of course, was to view the nobles, who began coming to him one at a time, asking after his health. Those sagging knees must have started rumors. Smiling, inquiring how long he intended to remain in Carrion this time, what his plans were if they might ask, smiling more, always smiling. The only one who did not smile at him so intently was Dobrain. Still with the front of his head shaved like a soldier, and the stripes across his coat worn by the breastplate he did not wear to the palace, and Dobrain was so glum in asking exactly the same questions that Rand was almost happier to see him go than any of the others. Min did manage to be at those audiences, squeezing it in between whatever she was doing with the wise ones. Rand had no intention of asking. The problem was keeping her hidden.
"I could just pretend to be your light skirt," Min laughed. "I could drape myself on you and feed you grapes. Well, raisins. I haven't seen a grape in some time. And you could call me your little honey lips. Nobody would wonder why I was there then."
"No," he snapped, and her face grew solemn.
"Do you really think the Forsaken will come after me just for that?"
"They might," he told her, just as seriously. "A dark friend like Padan Fain would, if he's still alive. I won't risk that, Min. In any case, I won't have these filthy-minded Kyrianen thinking of you that way, or the Tyrans either." The Aiel were different. They thought her teasing very funny, very amusing indeed. Min certainly was changeable. She went straight from solemn to radiant, with no in-between. All smiles that hardly faded for a moment, until the audiences actually began. A paneled screen of gilded fretwork set up in the corner of the anteroom was a failure. Maringill's dark, glittering eyes avoided looking at it to such an extent that Rand knew the man would turn the Sun Palace end over end to find out who or what it hid. The sitting room turned out better, with men peeping through cracked doors into the anteroom, but not everyone showed image or aura to her eyes during the audience with him, and what she did see, there, and simply walking about in the hallways, was bleak. Maringill, white-haired and blade-slim and cool as ice, was going to die by poison. Colivert, her more than handsome face calm and collected once she learned Avienda was not with Rand this time, would die by hanging. Mylan, with his pointed beard and oily voice, would die by the knife. The future carried a heavy toll for the High Lords of Tyr. Arakom and Marakan and Gwayam were all going to die too. Bloody deaths in battle, Min thought. She said she had never seen death so often in one group of people. By the time she saw blood covering Gwayam's broad face, their fifth day in Kyrian, she felt so ill at the thought that Rand made her lie down and had Sulin bring damp cloths to lay on her forehead. This time he was the one to sit on the mattress and hold her hand. She held on very tight. She did not give up her teasing, though. The two times he could be absolutely sure she would be there were when he practiced the sword, dancing the forms with four or five of the best he could find among the Tyran and Kyrianan soldiers, and when he and Ruark or Gaul were tossing each other about and trying to kick each other in the head. Inevitably, Min ran a finger across his bare chest and made some joke about sheep farmers not sweating because they were used to having wool as thick as their sheep or the like. Sometimes she touched the half-healed, never-healing scar on his side, that circle of pale pink flesh, but differently, softly. She never made any jokes about that. She pinched his bottom, startling to say the least, when other people were about. Maidens and wise ones nearly fell over laughing every single time he jumped. Sulin looked as if she might burst from not laughing. Snuggled in his lap and kissed him at every opportunity. She even threatened to come scrub his back in his bath one of these nights. When he pretended to weep and stammer, she laughed and said it was not good enough. Min did quit quickly enough if a maiden stuck her head in to announce someone, especially Loyal, who never stayed long and talked of the royal library the whole time, or Perrin, who stayed even more briefly, and for some reason looked increasingly tired. Most especially Min leaped up if Fael happened to be with either one. The two times that happened, Min hastily found a book among those Rand had in the bedchamber and sat pretending to read, opening it somewhere in the middle as if she had been at it for some time. Rand did not understand the cool looks the two women exchanged. It was not precisely animosity, or even unfriendliness, exactly. But Rand suspected that if either made a list of those she would just as soon not spend time with, the other's name would be prominent. The amusing thing of it was, the second time, the book turned out to be the leather-bound first volume of Darya Gahan's Essays on Reason, which he had found heavy going and intended to send back to the library the next time Loyal stopped in. Min actually went on reading for a time after Fail left, and for all her frowning and muttering, that night Min took it back to her own rooms in the guest apartments. If cool disinterest reigned between Min and Fail, between Min and Berylane, animosity was not in it. When Samara announced Berylane on the second afternoon, Rand put on his coat, strode into the anteroom, and took the tall gilded chair on the dais before telling Samara to admit her. Min was slow in reaching the sitting room, though. Berylane swept in, as beautiful as ever, in a soft blue dress cut as deeply as ever, and her eyes fell on Min in her pale rose coat and breeches. For several long moments, Rand might as well not have existed. Berylane openly eyed Min up and down. Min forgot about the sitting room. She put her hands on her hips and stood there, with one knee bent, studying Berylane just as openly. They smiled at each other. Rand thought the hair on his head would stand up when they did that. He was minded of nothing so much as two strange cats who had just discovered they were shut up in the same small room. Apparently deciding there was no point hiding now, Min walked. Undulated would have been a better word. She managed to make Berylane's way of walking look like a boy's, and sat with one knee over the other, still smiling. Light how those women did smile. At last Berylane turned to Rand, spreading her skirts wide and bending low. He heard Luce Theron humming in his head, enjoying the sight of a very beautiful woman who was more than generous in displaying her charms. Rand appreciated what he was seeing, too, despite wondering whether he should look away at least until she was erect again. But he had put himself on the dais for a reason. He tried to make his voice both reasonable and firm. "Ruark let slip that you were neglecting your duties, Berylane. It seems you hid away in your rooms for days after I was last here. I gather he had to speak to you severely to make you come out." Ruark had not actually said so, but that had been the impression. Crimson bloomed in her cheeks, suggesting Rand had the right of it. "You know why you are in charge here and not him. You're supposed to listen to his advice, not leave everything to him. I don't need Kyrianen deciding to rebel because they think I've put an Aiel to rule them."
"I was concerned, my lord dragon." Despite the hesitation and the red cheeks, her voice was composed. "Since the Aes Sedai came, rumors grow like weeds. May I ask, who do you mean to rule here?"
"Elaine Trakand, the daughter heir of Andor, the queen of Andor now. Soon, at least." "I don't know what rumors you mean, but you worry about putting Carian straight, and let me worry about the Aes Sedai. Elaine will be grateful for what you do here." Min sniffed quite loudly for some reason.
"She is a good choice," Berylane said thoughtfully. "The Kyrianen will accept her, I think, perhaps even the rebels in the hills."
That was good to hear. Berylane was astute at judging political currents, maybe as good as any Kyrianen. She took a deep breath, making Luce Theron's hum pause.
"As for the Aes Sedai, rumor says they have come to escort you to the White Tower."
"And I said, leave the Aes Sedai to me." It was not that he mistrusted Berylane. He trusted her to rule Kyrian until Elaine took the Sun Throne. He even trusted her not to have any ambitions for the throne herself. But he also knew that the fewer who were aware he had any plan at all regarding the Aes Sedai, the less chance that Corrin would learn he had a thought beyond her gold and jewels. As soon as the doors closed behind Berylane, Min sniffed again. Actually, it was more of a snort this time. "I wonder she bothers to wear any clothes at all. Well, she'll be snubbed up sooner or later. I saw nothing of any use to you,
just a man in white who will make her fall head over heels. Some women have no shame at all. That very afternoon she asked him for coin to engage a whole roomful of seamstresses, since she had come away from Camelin with only what she stood in, and they proceeded to produce a stream of coats and breeches and blouses in silks and brocades of all colors. Some of the blouses seemed quite low-cut, even beneath a coat. Some of the breeches he was not sure how she could get into. She also practiced throwing her knives every day. Once he saw Nandera and Anila showing her their way of fighting with hands and feet, which differed significantly from how the men did it. The maidens did not like him watching and refused to go on until he left. Maybe Perrin would have understood it all, but Rand decided for the thousandth time that he himself did not understand women, and never would. Every day Ruark came to Rand's apartment, so Rand went to the study Ruark shared with Berylaine. Rand was pleased to see her hard at work over reports of grain shipments and resettlement of refugees and repairs to damage from what some Kyrianen were calling the Second Aiel War, in spite of every effort to name it the Shido War. Ruark claimed to have decided to ignore the Kyrianen playing, as he called it, at Jieto, though he still grumbled every time he saw a Kyrianen woman with a sword or young men and women garbed all in white. The rebels still seemed to be sitting in the hills waiting, their numbers growing, but they did not concern him either. What did concern him were the Shido, and how many spears still moved south each day toward Tyr. Scouts, those who returned, reported the Shido stirring in Kinslayer's Dagger. There was no sign of which direction they intended to move or when. Ruark actually mentioned the number of Aiel who still gave way to the bleakness and tossed down their spears, the number who refused to put off Gaishine White when their time was done, even those few who still headed north to join the Shido. It was a sign of his unease. Surprisingly, Savanna had been in the tents, even in the city itself, leaving the day after Rand arrived. Ruark only mentioned it in passing. "Would it not have been better to seize her?" Rand asked. "Ruark, I know she is supposed to be a wise one, but she can't be, the way I understand it. I'd not be surprised if the Shido turned reasonable without her."
"I doubt that," Ruark said dryly.
He was seated on one of his cushions against the study wall, smoking his pipe.
"Amys and the others pass looks between Savannah's back, but they receive her as a wise one. If the wise ones say Savanna is a wise one, then she is. I have seen chiefs I would not waste a waterskin on if I stood between 10 pools, but they are still chiefs."
Sighing, Rand studied the map spread on the table. Ruark truly did not seem to need it. Without looking, he could name any feature of the terrain the map showed. Berylaine sat in her high-backed chair on the other side of the table, her feet curled up beneath her, and a sheaf of papers on her lap. She had a pen in her hand, and an ink jar stood on the small table beside her chair. Every so often she glanced at him, but whenever she saw Ruark looking, she would bend her head over the reports again. For some reason, Ruark frowned whenever he looked at her, and she always blushed and firmed her jaw stubbornly. Sometimes Ruark looked disapproving, which made no sense. She was taking care of her duties now. "You will have to stop sending spears south," Rand said at last. He did not like it. It was vital that some Aiel see the biggest hammer in the world coming at him, but not at the cost of having to root the Shido out of Kyrian again. "I don't see any other way." The days passed, and everyone filled somehow. He had smiling lords and ladies so cordial to one another that he was sure they were scheming against each other beneath the surface. Wise ones counseled him on how to deal with Aes Sedai, whether from the tower or Saladar. Amys and Bear made Mulaine appear mild. Sir Alea made his blood run cold. Young Kyrianen rioted in the streets against Ruark's ban on dueling. Ruark handled it by giving them a taste of what it was really like to be made Gaishine. Sitting naked in the sun all day under guard quenched their ardor somewhat, but Ruark was not about to go against custom so far as to put wetlanders in white, and those the Red Shields had caught actually began to swagger over the affair.
Rand overheard Salanda telling another young woman with a sword and her hair cut short, in a very self-important tone, that the other woman would never truly understand Giotto until she had been captive to Aiel. It was uplifting, whatever that was supposed to mean. But despite Shido and nobles, wise ones in riot, despite wondering whether Fel was ever going to come back from fishing, those days seemed pleasant, refreshing. Maybe it was just because he had been so tired on arrival. And maybe it really was only by comparison with those last hours in Camelin. Yet it did seem that Luz Theron was quieter. Rand even found himself enjoying Min's teasing enough that once or twice he had to remind himself that it was only teasing. By the time he had been 10 days in Carrion, he thought this would not be such a bad way to spend the rest of his life. Of course, he knew it could not last. For Perrin, those 10 days were not pleasant at all. Before very long, he sought Loyal's company, but Loyal had found a paradise in the Royal Library, where he spent the better part of every daylight. Perrin liked to read, and he might have enjoyed those seemingly endless rooms full of books to their high-vaulted ceilings, but an Aes Sedai haunted those rooms, a slender, dark-haired woman who seldom seemed to blink. She did not appear to notice him, but he had not been particularly trusting of Aes Sedai even before events in Camelin. With Loyal's company largely denied to him, Perrin went hunting a great deal with Gaul, and a few times with Ruark, who he had met in the stone and liked. Perrin's problem was his wife, or maybe it was Berylaine, or both. If Rand had not been so busy, Perrin would have asked his advice. In a general sort of way, Rand knew women, but there were things a man simply could not talk about right out. It began that very first day, when he had been in Carrion scarcely long enough to be shown to rooms in the Sun Palace. Fael went off with Bane and Chiad to explore, and he was stripped to the waist and washing, when he suddenly smelled perfume, not heavy, but strong to his nose, and a warm voice behind him said, "I always did think you must have a beautiful back, Perrin." He spun around so fast he nearly knocked over the washstand. "I hear that you have come with a wife." Berylaine stood in the door to the sitting room, smiling. Yes, he had. A wife who would not be pleased at finding him alone and shirtless with any woman wearing that dress. Especially not the first of Mayenne. Tugging his shirt over his head, he told Berylaine that Fael was out, that he did not know when she would be back for visitors, and put her out into the hall as fast as he could, without picking her up and tossing her. He thought it was done with. Berylaine was gone, and he had managed to call Fael wife 6 times in as many sentences, and say how much he loved her 2x. Berylaine knew he was married, knew he loved his wife, and that should have been that. When Fael returned a short time later, she took 2 steps into the bedchamber and began radiating the smells of jealousy and rage, prickly and knife-sharp, a blend that should have made his nose bleed. Perrin did not understand. He could still smell Berylaine's perfume, but his sense of smell was nearly as acute as a wolf's. Surely Fael could not. It was very strange. Fael smiled. Not one untoward word passed her lips. She was as loving as ever, and even more fierce than usual, raking deep furrows into his shoulders with her fingernails, which she had never done before. Afterwards, examining the bleeding gouges by lamplight, she nipped his ear between her teeth, not at all lightly, and laughed. "In Saldea," she murmured, "we notch a horse's ears. But I think that will do to mark you." And the whole while she fairly reeked of jealousy and rage. If that had been all, matters would have settled down. Fael's jealousy might flare up like a forge fire roaring in a high wind, yet it always died just as fast as it caught, once she realized there was no cause. The very next morning, though, he saw her talking to Berylaine down the corridor, both smiling to beat anything. His ears caught the last thing Berylaine said before she turned away. "I always keep my promises." an odd remark to send that acrid, thorny smell leaping from Fail. He asked Fail what promises Berlain was talking about, and maybe that was a mistake. She blinked. She did forget his hearing sometimes, and said,
"I really do not remember. She's the sort of woman who makes all sorts of promises she cannot keep."
His shoulders got a second set of furrows, and it was not even mid-morning. Berlain began stalking him. He did not think of it that way at first. The woman had flirted with him once in the Stone of Tyr, in a mild sort of way, not really meaning anything, he was sure, and she knew he was married now. It was only a series of chance encounters in hallways, it seemed, a few innocuous words almost in passing. But after a while he knew either his being Tavirin was twisting chance completely out of shape, or Berlain was arranging matters, unlikely as that seemed. He tried telling himself that was ridiculous. He tried telling himself he must think he was handsome as Will Alcine. Will was the only man he had ever seen women chase after. They certainly never had after Perrin Ibarra. There were just too many of those chance encounters, though. She always touched him, not blatantly, just fingers on his hand for a moment, on his arm, his shoulder, hardly worth noticing. The third day, a thought occurred that made the hair on the nape of his neck rise. When you were taming a horse that had never been ridden, you began with light touches until the animal knew your touch would not hurt, until it stood still for your hand. After that came the saddle cloth, and later the saddle. The bridle was always last. He began to dread the scent of Berlain's perfume wafting around a corner. He began to head in the opposite direction at the first whiff. Only he could not give every moment to watching for it. For one thing, there seemed to be a great many swaggering young Cariennan fools going in and out of the palace, most of them women. Women carrying swords. He walked around any number of men and women who planted themselves deliberately in his path. Twice he had to knock a fellow down when the idiot simply would not let him walk around, but kept dancing back in front of him. He felt bad about that. Cariennan were nearly all considerably smaller than he, but he could not take chances with a man who had his hand on his sword hilt. Once a young woman tried that, and after he took her sword away, she made a nuisance of herself until he gave it back, which seemed to shock her, then shouted after him that he had no honor until some maidens let her off, talking to her fiercely. For another thing, people knew he was Rand's friend. Even had he not arrived as he did, some of the Aiel and Tyrans remembered him from the stone, and word spread. Lords and ladies he had never seen in his life introduced themselves in hallways, and Tyran high lords who had stared down their noses at him in Tyr addressed him like an old friend in Cairhien. Most smelled of fear, and an odor he could not put a name to. They all wanted the same thing, he realized. "I'm afraid the Lord Dragon doesn't always take me into his confidence, m'lady," he said politely to a cold-eyed woman named Colivert. "And when he does, you wouldn't expect me to break that confidence." Her smile seemed to come from a great height. She seemed to be wondering how he would skin out from a lap rug. She had a strange smell, hard and smooth and somehow high. "I don't really know what Rand intends to do," he told Mylan. The man very nearly repeated his nose-staring, for all he smiled nearly as much as Colivert. He had the smell, too, just as potently. "Maybe you should ask him." "If I did know, I'd hardly talk it all over the city," he told a white-haired weasel with too many teeth, a fellow called Maringill. By then he was growing tired of attempts to milk him. Maringill also gave off the smell, every bit as heavily as Colivert or Mylan. They three carried it far more than anyone else. A dangerous smell, he knew in his bones, like a dry mountaintop before an avalanche. Between keeping an eye out for young idiots and having that smell in his nose, he could not recognize Berlain's scent until she had crept close enough to pounce. Well, truth to tell, she glided up along the hallways, a swan on a smooth pond, but it certainly felt like being pounced on. He mentioned Fail more times than he could count. Verlaine did not seem to hear. He asked her to stop. Verlaine asked him, whatever did he mean? He told her to leave him alone. Verlaine laughed and patted his cheek and asked what she was to stop doing, which, of course, had to be the exact moment that Fail came out of the next crossing corridor, just the instant before he jerked back. It must have seemed to Fail that he moved away because he saw her. Without a moment's hesitation, Fail turned smoothly on her heel, her pace not a whit slower or faster. He ran after her, caught up, and walked alongside in pained silence. A man could hardly say what he had to say where people could hear. Fail smiled quite pleasantly all the way back to their rooms, but oh, that thorny, thorny, thorny scent in his nose. "That wasn't what it looked like," he said as soon as the door was closed. Not a word out of her. Her eyebrows just rose in a silent question. "Well, it was." Verlaine patted my cheek. Still smiling, but eyebrows lowered darkly and sharp anger among the thorns. "But she just did it. I didn't encourage her, Fail. She just did it." He wished Fail would say something. She only stared. He thought she was waiting, but for what? Inspiration took him by the throat, and as so often seemed to happen when he was talking to her, put a noose around it. "Fail, I'm sorry." Anger became a razor. "I see," she said flatly, and glided out of the room. So, both feet put wrong, straight into his mouth, it seemed, though he could not understand how. He had apologized, and he had not even done anything to apologize for. That afternoon, he overheard Bane and Chia discussing whether they should help Fail beat him, of all things. No telling whether Fail had suggested it. She was fierce, but was she that fierce? Yet he suspected the pair meant him to hear, which made him angry. Plainly his wife was discussing affairs between him and her with them, matters which should have remained between husband and wife, which made him angrier. What other parts of their life did she chat about over tea? That night, as he watched in amazement, Fail put on a thick wool nightgown, despite the heat. When he tried to kiss her cheek, almost timidly, she muttered that she had had a tiring day and rolled over with her back to him. She smelled furious, sharp enough to split a razor edgewise. He could not sleep with that smell, and the longer he lay there beside her, studying the ceiling in the darkness, the angrier he became. Why was she doing this? Could she not see he loved her and only her? Had he not shown her time and again that what he wanted more than anything in life was to hold her forever? Was he to blame because some fool woman got a bee up her nose and wanted to flirt? What he ought to do was turn her upside down and smack her bottom till she saw sense. Only he had done that once before when she thought she could hit him with her fist whenever she wanted to make a point. In the long run, it had hurt him a lot more than it had her. He did not like even the thought of Fail being hurt. He wanted peace with her. With her and only her. Which was why he made the decision he made lying there, with gray first light of their sixth day in Carrion showing in the windows. In the stone, Verlaine had flirted with a dozen men that he knew of. Whatever had made her choose him as her quarry, she would settle on another if he was out of sight for very long. And once Verlaine chose another victim, Fail would come to her senses. It seemed simple. So, as soon as he could throw on some clothes, he went off to find Loyal and breakfast with him, then accompanied him to the Royal Library. Once he saw that slender Aes Sedai, and Loyal told him she was there every day. Loyal was diffident around Aes Sedai, but he did not mind 50 of them around him. Perrin sniffed out Gaul and asked whether he would like to go hunting. There were not many deer or rabbits in the hills close to the city, of course, and those few suffering as much from the drought as the people, yet Perrin's nose could have led them to any number they needed if meat had really been what he was after. He never even knocked an arrow, but he insisted on remaining out until Gaul asked whether he intended hunting bats by the light of the half-moon. Sometimes Perrin forgot that other people could not see as well as he in the night.
The next day he hunted into the darkness as well, and every day thereafter. The problem of it was, his simple plan seemed to be falling on its nose. The first night when he returned to the Sun Palace, with his unstrung bow on his shoulder, pleasantly tired from all that walking, only a chance stir in the air brought Berylane's scent in time to stop him from walking into the main entry hall of the palace. Motioning the Aiel guards to silence, Perrin sneaked all the way around to a servant's door, where he had to pound to make a bleary-eyed fellow let him in. The next night, Berylane was waiting in the hallway outside his rooms. He had to hide around a corner half the night before she gave up. Every night she was waiting somewhere, as if she could pretend a chance encounter, when no one else was awake but a few servants. It was utter madness. Why had she not gone on to someone else? And every night, when he at last crept into his bedchamber with his boots in his hands, Fael was asleep in that bloody thick nightgown. Long before his sixth sleepless night in a row, he was ready to admit he had blundered, though he still could not see how. It had seemed so bloody simple. All he wanted was one word from Fael, one hint of what he should say or do. All he got was the sound of his own teeth grinding in the darkness. On the tenth day, Rand received another request from Coiran for an audience, just as politely worded as the first three. For a time he sat rubbing the thick, creamy parchment between thumb and forefinger, thinking. There was really no way to tell how far Alana was yet from his sense of her, but comparing how strong it had been the first day with how strong it was now, he thought she might be halfway to Cairhien. If that was so, Mirana was not dawdling. That was good. He wanted her eager. Penitent, at least a little, would help too, but as well wish for the moon. She was Aes Sedai. 10 more days until they reached Cairhien, if they kept that pace, and they should be able to. Time enough to meet twice more with Coiran, so he would have given each group 3 audiences. Let Mirana consider that when she arrived. No advantage to her at all. The White Tower on the other side, and no need for her to know he would as soon stick his hand into a viper pit as go anywhere near the tower, especially with Elida as Amarlin. 10 more days, and he would eat his boots if 10 more passed beyond that before Mirana agreed to throw Saladar's support to him, with no nonsense about guiding or showing the way. Then at last he could turn his full attention on Samael. As Rand sat to write Corin that she could bring 2 of her sisters to the Sun Palace tomorrow afternoon, Luce Theron began muttering audibly.
"Yes, Samael. Kill him this time. Dimundred and Samael and all of them this time. Yes, I will."
Rand hardly noticed.